So, good morning, everyone. It's my pleasure to introduce you to Melissa O'Neill. She's the Chief Executive Officer of Central Iowa Shelter and Services, and this is a position that she's held for the past 8 years. I met Melissa 6 years ago while advocating for my downtown neighborhood and acknowledging really the good work that she's doing at the Central Iowa Shelter and Services. Prior to her position with Central Iowa Shelter and Services, Melissa was the Vice President of IJAG, Iowa Jobs for America's Graduates. She was a Challenge Course Coordinator for Iowa State University Extension. She has consistently served in leadership roles, including Assistant Women's Basketball Coach at Indiana University and Graduate Assistant Women's Basketball Coach at Syracuse University. She leads with passion and purpose. She received her bachelor's in communications from Clarion University of Pennsylvania and her master's in advertising from Syracuse University. Melissa resides in Indianola with her husband Jeremy, daughter Katie, son Patrick. Melissa will be able to share with you in short order several of the programs in place at Central Iowa Shelter and Services, which are well organized, I would say, at their website, centraliowashelter.org. Please join me in welcoming Melissa.
Well, good morning. I'm going to use my basketball voice if that's okay. I hope everybody can hear me online. I'm not usually a fan of podiums, and here's why. What do you know about somebody who stands behind a podium? They're typically known as an expert. I'm not an expert. Okay? So one of the things that I know to be true is that we can actually solve a lot of society's wicked hard challenges by actually turning the podium around and by working together and collectively rather than just the voice of one person. And so today I want to turn the podium around because truly the experts are in the room. And if we want to solve whether it be homelessness or food insecurity or creating a self-sufficient lifestyle for so many Americans that are marginalized by our society, we have to turn the podium around. It's not just the person standing behind the microphone. So I'll slow down for a second because I was telling Deb one of the things that I enjoy about these morning breakfasts is simply I don't have to give the 30-second elevator speech. And I can really pause and help more people understand truly the mission of Central Iowa Shelter and what we do in our community. Because I think oftentimes people just don't know. We are oftentimes in the shadows of Des Moines. When I started this position 8 years ago, I was driving up over the bridge in Martin Luther King Boulevard in from Fluor, and I saw the same gorgeous sunrise that I see this morning, and I saw the shadows that were casting down across our building. And you can't help but pause to say, how do we light up Des Moines? Because when our building gets better, when we get better, when we improve our process, when we improve our systems, Des Moines, the county, and the state get better. It lifts all boats. And so for some people that now drive down MLK, you may see a giant 3,600 square foot greenhouse in our backyard. It's our first attempt of lighting up Des Moines. If you fly over Des Moines, you can't help but see that beacon. Now, FAA was not a fan of me actually throwing a beacon up into the light. So we've done some other things like the greenhouse, and soon the west wall of our building will be completely lit up. So coming soon, that will actually be another beacon, another art piece to tell our story about what's actually happening within our facility. So we're having some fun conversations about are we going to share what is our bed capacity? How many pounds of food have we given away or grown? How many people have moved into permanent housing? So we're going to have some fun with the lighting of that. But there's one thing I want you to know. If you ever drive by and you see that light turned off, just say a quick prayer for us. Because we know we lost somebody on the streets. So we actually have an app on my phone, and when I get that notice, we'll just turn the lights off. It's a stark reminder because they wouldn't let me send the beacon up. So we're just gonna turn them off and remind people that we gotta do better. We gotta turn this podium around a little bit more often. So I'll back up for a second. So you may wonder, how did you go from college basketball coach to this job, right? So let's start at the beginning. You might see I've got my Iowa gear on today. We do have an Iowa party at the shelter if anybody wants to join us. We're having our own tailgating. I'm pretty sure we got popcorn, cotton candy, and ice cream for anybody that's interested. But long story short, I grew up in West Branch, Iowa. I grew up in a small town. I was telling Deb I was brainwashed by the Herbert Hoover Museum. I think everybody from the, you go to school in West Branch, yeah, you're shaking your head, you know this, right? From the time you're pre-K, you become a junior park ranger. And you actually help every tourist that comes through the town understand where his house is actually at. And so growing up, I had no idea the impact that that would have on my life today. But I did know by the time I was in fifth grade, the one thing I wanted to do was be a college women's basketball coach. And every decision I made was to go down that path. So yes, I played in college, did basketball and track in a Division II school, but really learned from somebody by the name of C. Vivian Stringer. Does anybody here know C. Vivian? Okay. So C. Vivian was my first mentor. Her assistant coaches, Mariana Freeman, who was the head coach at Syracuse, and Angie Lee became, and Angie still to this day is a great friend, have become those women in my life who helped me realize that it wasn't basketball that I was actually yearning for. It was about helping that next person up in line. It was about putting your hand out and saying, okay, I've made it. Now let's get you up here too. And it wasn't necessarily always about giving a hand out. And so as I went through life, Angie and I sat down at several Final Fours where she really said, Melissa, what is it really about basketball? And what I loved is they actually sent me to places in the heart of Philadelphia, Toronto, Cleveland, Columbus, and my job was to find the diamond in the rough. And when you walk into a gym and everyone realizes you're the one with the scholarship, it's a totally different mindset. Whether it's black, brown, there are times I would walk in, I'd be the only white person in the gym, but they knew that if that one diamond in the rough was found, it was an opportunity for a full ride scholarship to Syracuse. So some of you may know, you had a superstar right here at Hoover High School, Jazinga Tracy. Anybody ring the bell? So Z is her nickname. She ended up becoming an All-American for me at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. It was actually my father, who was a school teacher for 30 years, kept bugging me. Have you ever had that parent that just says, hey, you got to, and you just kept that, just kept ignoring them until I saw the game film. And then I made a reason to come home. But Z ended up being a four-year All-American, took Indiana University to two national championships, and played overseas for 4 or 5 years upon graduation. And now she lives in Grimes and runs a daycare facility, following in her mother's footsteps. So believe it or not, we've got more individuals in our community that are like that and just need to be given a chance and just need an opportunity, again, for all of us to turn the podium around and know that each one of you are a mentor in somebody's life. That somebody is watching your every movement in hopes to someday be you. And so leaving Syracuse, going to Indiana, Pennsylvania, I had my daughter, Katie. And at that point in time, I realized my husband was really a single dad. I was traveling so much with basketball, I missed a lot of her firsts. And as a young mom, when you see your daughter, it was actually my mom that told her, say, hey, take this to your mom. And I saw her walk for the first time, but she'd actually been walking for 2 or 3 weeks and I just wasn't home. So that was the moment I decided to hang up the whistle and that it was time to move back home to Iowa and raise my daughter. So I had a great time at Iowa State University teaching social and emotional intelligence on a ropes course, which I promise you will apply back here in a second. And then a terrific opportunity to move on to IJAG, teaching project-based learning and helping across the entire state of Iowa to bring experiential education into the classroom. So you can imagine with this background, as I lean into the position at Central Iowa Shelter, it all started because of the number of students that we have in our school system experiencing homelessness. And it's hidden. There's over 1,000 students just in Des Moines Public Schools that are couch surfing because they are in lifestyles and environments that families and sleeping on couches is their only option. And in fact, as we've done some interviews, and we have a reveal that will be coming up here on May 2nd, we've done some interviews with these young adults, and I didn't realize this until we'd met with them, how much we've taught them to live out of their backpack. Think about it. Backpack Buddies program. It's where it started, according to the people we've interviewed. The electronic devices in our hands allow them access to absolutely everything all the time. And you have no idea what kind of life they're actually living because they can fake it on social media. So when you start thinking through all the different dynamics, and I don't know as much about Des Moines, but in Indianola school system, they took our kids' lockers away. My son doesn't have a locker anymore. He literally carries a backpack. So when we taught our children that mobility and living out of a backpack is a lifestyle and a way of going about it, all of a sudden when we were at IJAG, we started to see more and more and more young adults living out of their backpacks. And I got exposed to CISS for the very first time when we had a student at Lincoln High School that was actually staying in the building that I work in today. He was 18 years old, so he was an adult. He had to stay in our building. He couldn't go to the youth shelter. And he would get up every single morning. He'd participate in every single extracurricular activity that he could. He'd go to Lincoln High School. He'd grab a shower. He'd go to class all day. He was in our IJAG classroom for extracurricular. And then he decided to join the military because we give you a better bed at the shelter if you're in the military. And so he decided to become a reservist in the National Guard. So that was my first exposure. And my eyes were completely opened. To this day, CISS is your largest emergency shelter in the state of Iowa. We have 150 emergency shelter beds. About 54% of the people we serve are residents of Des Moines. And about 84% of those individuals are residents of the state of Iowa. This winter, in January, everybody remembers that cold spell that we had, minus 45 degrees, you know, a couple inches of snow on the ground. It was a challenge for our team to get to and from work, but it was even more challenging to go out there and find those individuals that were our hidden homeless and bring them into shelter. On our coldest night, we had 326 people in our building. So I know Matt's here, Kevin's here. These two were absolutely instrumental in making sure that we had the support that we needed for our staff to do their jobs. There's nothing more surreal than when you're trying to keep 326 people alive and fed. And you imagine, I don't know about all of you, but if I had to sleep in an environment with that many people, I'm sure my mental health would really struggle as well. And so having our law enforcement, having our fire department in our building with us, serving alongside as social workers, was absolutely pivotal to keeping people alive and safe and getting people stably housed. There was one day we had 54 individuals check into the building in one day that were brand new to our system. And so it escalates really, really fast. And so I share all this not necessarily to make you feel bad, but to recognize the scope and the work and the breadth of that we have to do every day. In October of this last year, we actually started something called a by name list. By name list actually took an emergency management approach to ending homelessness and treating it as if it was a natural disaster. No different than a tornado or a derecho or a flood that comes through our community. The very first thing we do is we create a by name list of everyone impacted by that weather event, and we do our best to find them and to make sure that they have Maslow's hierarchies of needs taken care of. A basic shelter, food, clothing, their health taken care of. So why wouldn't we take that same approach? So I think part of the reason why we had 326 people in the building is we know everybody by name who is unsheltered in our community right now, and everybody within our building. I get a situation report at 9:30 every single morning of the number of people that are needing help. And it far and exceeds our capacity to serve. So when we have these extreme weather events, it's community members like you, it's our churches, it's our political leaders that really come up and they step up to help us make sure that we can continue to serve at the level that is needed for our society today. So with that being said, let me give you some good news. 55% of the residents that check into our building are housed in 15 days or less. 55% stably housed. It's a blip on the radar. They're in, they're out. Oftentimes, it's just through a simple, if you've ever done life coaching, this is where my basketball hat comes on. It's all about how do we empower? Instead of necessarily assuming that somebody is going to need a handout for the rest of their life, it's how do we empower, how do we develop, how do we build their personal self-efficacy, their agency, to know that they can too make an impact in the world today. So it's through that personal agency and the development and growth that actually we're able to stably house 60% of our clients in 30 days or less. And oftentimes the number one thing they ask me for is not housing. It's a job, a meaningful job, one with purpose and passion
that they can feel as if they can contribute back to society today. And those that find that job on their own, again, build more personal agency and understanding that they too can have an effect in the world. So when we are able to move 60% of our system out of our building in 29 days or less, we are able to then maintain those beds and to keep people safe within our facility. So those blips on the radar are truly that, they're blips. But we're able to move people quickly through that system. Outside of our emergency shelter, we have 81 apartments. Oftentimes people think that second and third floor in our building is more shelter beds. It's actually not. We call that a supportive housing is permanent. It's a long story as to how it got that title, but essentially we are everybody's last chance. So if somebody has ever been evicted from multiple different locations or have had a major mental health or unmedicated mental health diagnosis, or even a severe substance abuse or in recovery, those apartments are meant for you. The rents on those apartments are $514 a month, with 44 of those units being subsidized through Des Moines Municipal Housing and their project-based voucher program, and 19 of those units dedicated to veterans. And those beds are full. So we have the opportunity to move people that are unsheltered into shelter and then upstairs if need be. And then from upstairs, we help them move on, again, to become productive members of our society and to other locations of their choice. Through all of this, we look at our zip code data to determine where are people coming from, right? So that we can do a better job serving people where they come from. So we now serve 15 counties outside of Polk. Two of those counties make up the highest population of individuals that we receive people from. One of them being Wapello County and Ottumwa, which we are now working to establish a facility just like ours in Ottumwa. And that will break ground hopefully this September. And there'll be an adaptive reuse of some additional space as long as some new construction as well. And then the other one is actually Poweshiek County and Grinnell. Grinnell and Ottumwa. Grinnell, in Newton a little bit. And that has a lot to do with what's happening in Marshalltown. A lot of people are heading to Grinnell. We work very, very closely with their community leaders to put people up in a hotel through non-congregate and then turn around and, if necessary, transport them to our facility. But our hope is actually to stop it at the door, to reduce the number of people that are coming to our urban core seeking emergency shelter and supportive services. We're working now to help them in their hometown, where they have a social network, where they have community that's built, and honestly, where they want to be. So during that cold snap that we had, we literally had individuals who were living in their cars in rural Iowa, living in places not meant for habitation, and working with local sheriff's departments across those counties to actually transport them into our shelter. And then at the end of the weather event, we actually took them back home. But because they didn't have a warming facility or a facility available in their community, we had to find a way to keep people alive. And now we're expanding into those regions. In 2026, we'll expand into Knoxville. We have a great partnership now established with a developer in Knoxville that will be setting up a facility to serve the Knoxville Pella community. And shortly in 2026, we'll head to Centerville. Centerville is seeing another huge increase in homeless population with no shelter available and no big supportive services for housing. They come here to Des Moines for those helps. So we're actually going to go and serve them in their hometown as well, continuing to make sure that our facility remains available for the city of Des Moines and for Polk County residents. So I'll pause because that's a little bit of housing. There's a whole lot more I can talk about in housing. And if you really want to get into all the HUD funding that we receive to keep people in their hometown, I'm happy to do that. But are there any questions on the shelter and housing aspects of what we do?
I live actually at 111 City Loft, so near the shelter on Cherry. So I see a lot of what's going on, and yeah. I just don't understand the changes. Like, there's a building that it used to be, that's where you took building. Donations. Now, I don't know where you take donations. It's you know, it's got a fence around it. So what's going on with all that?
Yeah, so that's actually our old building. So you're asking what specifically is happening with the building across the street? That's actually our old building. So okay. In 1995, Bill Knapp actually built that building. We were Churches United. 8 churches had come together in downtown community and basically said enough is enough. 5 people had perished on the streets of Des Moines and they were fed up. So those churches had essentially come together. In 95, that building was built. In 2007, I'm going to look at Matt for a second, 2007-ish is when the drama started of Not My Backyard, because there was an attempt to move and to expand the number of beds
to meet the growing population of Des Moines over to Kiowa. 2010-ish, it escalated a little bit more, and even you would see some of our political leaders actually going to head on the same conversation within city council meetings. Became very, very challenging time. In 2012, Matt was a part of it, I know, so I keep looking to Matt. Jim County was brought in, along with the several other political leaders, and I believe the total was $15 million was raised in roughly 6 months. Matt helped us when you were in the Senate to secure the funding for the second floor apartments. And then the VA brought in for the third floor apartments, and so everybody had a little bit of stake in the game in the building that we have today. Did I get that timeline about right? The scary thing is this, is we're getting ready for our Heroes for the Homeless event on May 2nd, and I'm going back through the news and the archives. We have all of our news articles, and what's scary is nothing's changed. I'm having the same conversations today that I read about in those news articles. What are we doing with the campers? What are we doing with tiny homes? What are we doing with cottages, right? We still are struggling to create the strategic plan that we need as a community to not only end homelessness, but to get ahead of it. So the building across the street is our old facility that was bought by DMARC. That was their distribution facility before they built and expanded then on the south side. That will actually be turned into luxury housing. Now, this was by far the best conversation I've ever had. So if you've ever been to a planning and zoning where you hear not in my backyard, imagine when I received a phone call that said, hey, Melissa, we want to build luxury housing across the street. I was like, awesome, let's schedule that. So I get on the call with this developer, and the developer actually is from Chile. So the land a property owner thought they were buying land next to the Pro Iowa Soccer Stadium. So when I got on that phone call, and I knew what the call was going to be about, because they had no idea they bought land next to the largest shelter in the state, it was really funny when I just said, I'm like, listen, let's just start this off. Let's just be candid with one another, because I don't want any problems with your people across the street. So we laughed, right? And then it basically cut through, because that's exactly why we were having the call. That was the whole premise of the call. So I do see an off-duty officer job in somebody's future, especially with all the glass windows that they've proposed as a part of this building. I know much how much windows I've replaced in my building in 8 years. Those don't stand a chance. So really had an opportunity with the developers to be a part of the architectural designs that were going to be needed. We knew there were going to be challenges. There are going to be challenges. But the more we can stay in open, honest dialogue with one another, the more relationships we can have, the more candor we can have, the more we can show this community is possible. And it can work. So when I went to the last planning and zoning meeting, and they didn't know what I was going to say, but the reality was is I wanted P&Z to know that this can be a role model for our community's future. That we can, through a social housing, have housing for everybody in a variety, a mixture, a tapestry of work in our community. And so it doesn't have to be a not in my backyard. Because I don't know about you, but if you guys go to a coffee shop or even eat at Gateway Market, many of those individuals are making 15 to 20 bucks an hour. If you are living in downtown Des Moines right now, 50% of the residents downtown are rent burdened. 50%, 17% spend more than half of their income on housing. So it is possible, but the reality is the individuals living in that luxury housing across the street are probably going to be food insecure. The data and the math tells me that they're going to be moving into those units and be cost burdened. And by the way, I just told you my rent is $514. Theirs, minimum $1,500. The apartments are the exact same size. So it is possible for us to do this, and I hope that we can role model that all up and down Mulberry Street for the rest of our community and really for our suburban community as well. If we can show that this can work, which we're determined to do, there's no excuse for anybody else. So it's a great, great question, but that's what's happening in the building. The donations can actually come in the back of our building. We're working on signage right now for the city of Des Moines, because that's a question that comes up. Can we put a sign about donations? If you've been down Mulberry Street lately, you'll know that there's actually quite a bit of construction and economic development that's happening around us. We've got the Ingersoll runway or runoff that's going to be under construction again here very shortly, so the road will actually be closed. The demo on that building across the street starts July 1. We have current housing on 12th and Cherry, which is a mixed-use, mixed development across from the parking garage that will be developed. So we are right in the thick of everything. So we've got some other tactics and strategies I'll get into on what we're doing to support the downtown community, not just during the construction, but with some of the other concerns that the Neighborhood Association has spoken about. So, yeah, Trudy.
Can you talk about the agri-hood?
I can. So the question is, can I talk about the agri-hood? Does anybody know what an agri-hood is? A little bit? Okay. So long story short, 2017, another one of those historical moments with CISS, we had 40-ish tent campers in the 4-acre water retention basin around us. Not very sightly for our community, and especially from an economic development standpoint, coming up over MLK, yeah, your role, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It was also, I think, the second now coldest spurt in time that we had, and we had a lot of snow. Well, there was a point in time during that I actually had one of the campers come in and wanted to meet with me because the city clearing out their camp was hurting his business. And as a business owner, I'm like, sure, I'd love to hear about how the city's hurting your business. Like, I can advocate for that, right? And so he comes in, he sits down, and he goes, well, here's the deal, Melissa. If the city cleans out the tents, I won't have a rental program. I was like, excuse me? So he rented the tents. We would house somebody. A tent was frozen to the ground. He would rent it out. Brilliant business plan. The guy actually ended up buying a house with the revenue from his tent rental program. He's no longer, he's self-sufficient, let's put it that way. But at that moment in time, I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. I never in a million years thought about that. However, the individuals I serve every day are no different than all of us here. They are absolutely brilliant, and they are innovative, and they are survivors, and they will find a way. And so I'm like, okay, we got to do something with this water retention basin, or I'm gonna continue to have this problem. So we decided to buy it. So we bought it from the city of Des Moines for $1,000. 4 acres downtown Des Moines. I'm like, that's a great deal. I grew up in rural Iowa where farmland's a lot more expensive than that. And then it was really awesome when the city of Des Moines had to pay me back for the easement for that Ingersoll water runoff. So I ended up breaking even. So long story short, we said, what are we going to do with this? We got 4 acres downtown Des Moines. How does this connect to our mission? So I was late for breakfast at a breakfast meeting, and I met with a gentleman by the name of Matt Carlisle from Confluence. If anybody knows Matt, yep. So I said, Matt, what would you do? I mean, you're a landscape architect. You build these gorgeous parks all across the country. Like, how would you solve this problem? Here's our mission. And he comes back with this idea. And he says, Melissa, why don't you build an urban farm? Why don't you build an agri-hood? And I'm like, yeah, but it's a water retention basin. You know, the city says I'm not allowed to plant anything that would potentially block the flow of water. He goes, okay. He goes, well, I got a fishing trip with a buddy coming up. Let me talk to you when I get back. Well, I didn't know his fishing trip with his buddy was actually a gentleman that owns a pontoon boat company. And he says, well, Matt, he goes, the technology already exists. Boat docks. So to date, we actually have a USDA innovation grant and a patent on raised floating beds. So they're actually an injection mold company in Cass, Iowa, in Atlantic, Cass County, that's actually building for us raised floating beds, just like a boat dock, that will be inside of the agri-hood. And if the agri-hood ever floods, they float right up on top of the water. All the food is completely protected, and then it goes right back down. That is all ADA accessible. We did everything 14 inches up so that if you were in a wheelchair, you could still go down and access the food. We've also planted 50 fruit and nut trees. And again, that beacon of light in our backyard, that 3,600 square foot greenhouse, I am now also your largest tilapia farmer in the state of Iowa. And we produce 5,500 heads of lettuce every single month. That food goes directly into our community kitchen program, one of our 10 meal site programs. It goes into our food pantry and into our kitchen. Now, I'll pause for a second. Has anyone here ever eaten at Big Grove, St. Kilda's, Des Moines Golf and Country Club? Anything like that? Okay, perfect. You're eating my lettuce. Okay, so that's the part of the ag program that a lot of people don't know about in your own backyard. It is run by the residents within our emergency shelter. It is a part of a SNAP employment and training grant. We receive private donors and corporate donors for our farm, and the state of Iowa SNAP E&T gives us 50 cents on the dollar back for the continued development of that program. We have work readiness, a supervised job search, 4 actual job training programs, 2 of them being the kitchen and the farm. And then we do job retention services to help people stay employed, stay housed for 90 days after they exit our facility. But the farm is actually the most popular program that we have. So many of our residents metaphorically are planting seeds, learning about the right water, the right amount of nutrients, the right amount of sunlight in order for something to flourish and grow. And when they get an opportunity staying in our facility to plant that seed and then see what they're able to produce out of it, it creates purpose. It creates community. And all of a sudden, it's actually one of the hardest programs for us to get somebody out of. They never want to leave the building when they're a part of the farm program. So we took the next step. I mentioned we're the largest tilapia farmer. We also received a 3-year USDA grant for a food truck. So you will now drive in the back of our facility and you will see the Mulberry Farm and Food truck. So that's our DBA. That's how people don't have NIMBYism on our lettuce. They see it coming from the farm and not from the shelter. But for every fish taco we sell, every taco salad I sell, we will now give one away in our community for free. We're working with our local leaders to look at what are those neighborhoods across our community who are food insecure, where we can provide a free, healthy, nutritious meal through our food truck with dignity, with respect, but it's all grown right in your own backyard. The food in the farm, we're not fencing it in. It is 100% free to absolutely everybody, including those that are going to be renting those luxury units across the street. Because we know that food insecurity just does not make sense in the state of Iowa. I mentioned I grew up in West Branch, brainwashed by the Hoover Museum, right? It just does not make sense that we do not have a food secure state. So equal to our housing, we are equally as committed to creating that food secure state, to working with our local community, and not just this 4-acre urban farm, not just with our food truck, by providing healthy, nutritious food to 10 meal sites in the metro of Des Moines. Partnering with Can Play, Des Moines Parks and Rec, the Des Moines Police Department, they provide a lot of the physical activities. We provide the sugar snap peas, the cherry tomatoes, the green beans, the fresh lettuce that oftentimes is outside of somebody's budget who is living in a food insecure world. It is easy to buy the fast, easy, convenient food. It's cheap, right? But it's not good for the overall health and wellness of our society. So when we talk about food and behavior, the food side, we ensure healthy, nutritious, homegrown vegetables are served within our shelter every single day. In fact, I started saying no to food rescue that was processed, and I thought my staff was going to kill me. The clients loved it. They're tired of the cupcakes. They're tired of the cookies. They're tired of the processed breads. They want the same healthy, nutritious food that we all get to go home and eat every day. So Agrihood, I think that sums it up, but you're all more than welcome to come down for a tour, but you will see that under construction. The raised beds are supposed to go in this July. So we hope to still get a fall crop, but yeah.
I had a question. You mentioned several of the communities that you're mm-hmm. reaching out to, and it sounded like, is there something going on in rural Iowa and in regards to homelessness and the need that we're kind of missing?
Yeah. So the question, is there something going on in rural Iowa that essentially demonstrates the need that our community is missing? And yes, right? So I want you to think about it, even mentioned it. When you're downtown around our building, homelessness is really visible, right? If you're downtown Des Moines, if you head to Starbucks, it is very visible. And the further you start to get away from the urban core, let's take West Des Moines, Johnston, Ankeny, Altoona, Pleasant Hill, you don't see as much, right? But that doesn't mean it's not there. Then you get even further out, your Carlisle, Indianola, and the further you start to get away from the core, the more hidden it becomes. And the scariest part is the number of children that are homeless within our society today. So we are obviously focused on the adult side, but what we've learned going into rural Iowa is how many hidden homeless exist within our communities every day. So I mentioned my daughter goes to Iowa State now. She was a senior in high school when we did this research study. And I came home and I was like, Katie, how many of your classmates at Indianola are homeless right now? Like, how many? She was like, oh, mom, 5. I go, what? She named them. I go, you're kidding me. She goes, no, mom. So-and-so's parents are divorced. Dad drinks a lot. Mom's gone. She travels for work. And I go, okay, so he's still housed. And she goes, mom, no, he's not. He goes, his parents have no idea where he's at. He slept in his car in the parking lot. He couch surfs every single night. Dad's not calling mom to check on him. Mom's not home to know that his son's even gone. She thinks he's with dad. And this becomes a part of our generational gap and hidden homelessness across our entire community. And she could name 5 in less than 30 seconds. So then we go into Ottumwa. 26% of our school-aged youth in Wapello County are experiencing homelessness. The vacancy rate for housing in Ottumwa is at 10%. You can't get a developer to come in and build new housing in Ottumwa when you have a 10% vacancy rate within your current housing stock. And that housing stock is dilapidated. You wouldn't want to live there. And so it's escalating. I'll be honest, I'm extremely concerned about Perry. Even though Perry is not technically within our service area, we know the impact, the life events that have taken place there are going to lead to more people experiencing homelessness if we don't start putting a stake in the ground and doing more prevention now. So that is a big part. Domestic violence is really, really high. It's very hidden in our rural communities. And unfortunately, we continue to lose funding in our DV shelters for victims of crime. And even all of you, I'm sure, have experienced at some point in time a victim of a crime, yet it's brushed under the rug as if it doesn't exist, because in this case, somebody may be experiencing homelessness. Most of the individuals within our facility are victims of crime. Yeah, but it's getting worse.
So what can we do as citizens in this area to help these efforts? You're talking to us, all the things you're doing.
Yeah.
What can we do and what's our contribution other than money and donations?
Yeah, so what can you do with a contribution? Help us solve this problem, right? Perfect. Love the segue. We've got two projects that are currently happening. We need insights. The first one I mentioned will be deployed at our Heroes for Homeless event. It's no secret. We are building a social determinants of health app. Looking at the data, 40% of the individuals that are calling 211 are asking for rental assistance and help, but nothing exists. And our system is horrible. It's extremely complex, it's very political, and it's really, really hard for somebody who is on the edge to navigate the system without help. So we are creating an app to essentially allow people in our community anonymously to navigate the system and even ask for help, where they can help figure out, how do I actually get rental assistance? So I'll give you an example. You may go to a church, and that church provides utility deposits and first month's rent. And then you go over here, and this one does security deposits and will help you get your driver's license. If you don't ask in the right order, you may ask for the wrong thing. Make sense? So that is the same with nonprofit service providers. And we have one that, unfortunately, you have to be on the verge of an eviction. Think about the trauma that has mentally before you're able to get help. Yet the money is there. Our state actually has financial resources that my peer service providers across the state have buried their heads in the sand and they're not spending. And if we do not spend this faster, our governor will give it back. We know that. She's proven it over and over and over again. But we have financial resources available for homeless prevention, diversion, rapid resolution, rapid rehousing, so you never have to experience the trauma of being homeless or staying a night in our facility. So the app becomes really important to us spreading the message and spreading the word that there is a homeless prevention tool out there to help people simplify the system. We also don't know what we don't know. So we will use 211, Find Help, and Unite Else to help with those resource platforms. But we're also very similar creating our own version of Angie's List, because you can go on those resources and they'll tell you about them. Like, if you say you're homeless, it'll actually send you to the federal building. That's what they do right now. It's not real helpful, right?
So an Angie's List version of it, where in the app, people using the app will actually be able to say, yes, this facility was open, and yes, this facility was helpful. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is more of the back door. If you say you need to help and you want to talk, in Polk County, that phone call will actually right now go to NAMI Iowa for a mental health support. So we want to make sure, think about it like this. Has anybody ever done a polar plunge? Okay, you can visualize how awful that sounds. Okay, so when you first, you have a situation in your life that something happens and all of a sudden you fall off that cliff. When you first jump in or hit that water, your body is shocked. You hit a massive fight or flight. So I mentioned the challenge ropes course world. Did you know the same physiological response happens in your body going ziplining in the woods as it does to a crucial conversation, as it does when you ask for help, when you knock on that door? So when your body first hits the water, it's when you are the highest motivation to get out of the situation that you're currently in, which is why I mentioned 55% of our residents are housed in 15 days or less. They hit that water, they've knocked on the door, they are highly motivated. The longer they have to stay within our system, the more the motivation decreases and the more frustrating it becomes for an individual. Even if you see somebody who's food insecure, right? I don't know about you, I got home at 8 o'clock last night, I was hangry. My son knew I was hangry and he had a steak on the grill, okay? But the reality is I tell you that because the longer you wait, the worse your mental health will start to become. You get frustrated, you get mad, okay? And then sometimes you just quit and you don't think anybody cares. Or we create a system where we've enabled everybody and now they're codependent upon us to survive. Why? Because they never got their basic needs met when they first hit that water. So the app actually has the resources and tools to make sure we're capturing people before they hit that water. And if they hit that water, we're addressing it as soon as we possibly can through a mental health lens. We're also partnering up with Iowa Community Hub, who is placing navigators with HHS across the state of Iowa to make sure that outside of our team in the 16 counties we serve, you've got an actual social worker to talk to. So there's the anonymous version, and then there's this version where you can actually identify yourself, which allows us to help you quicker, okay? Now, that's one side of it. This is where we need help. We need to make sure we're deploying the app and getting it into the hands of Iowans as soon as we possibly can. We also don't know what can of worms we're opening. We look at key performance indicators just like everybody else, and one of our biggest key performance indicators is food insecurity. So if I know that I have 65,000 unique individuals that are using our food pantry system right now, that means they're struggling to put food on the table or pay rent. They're having to make that hard decision. Getting the app into the hands of the individuals using our food pantry system, into the hands of our students and schools, allows us then to serve people before they hit our shelter. It's the hidden homeless. So the deployment of that app is critical. Insights from all of you. How do we make it better? We are in the minimum viable product is done. The frameworks are done. We are now developing the 1.0 version. We are now getting that one coded up for us. That's what you'll actually see on your phone. But in September, we are creating 2.0. So we need people to use the app and tell us how to make it better. How do we get better? What are we missing? Is there a language that we're not using that needs to be empowered? So we want the community to help us create 2.0. In all of that, and Kevin, I'll be knocking on your door shortly. We have partnered up with 6 other states. One of the other states, I mentioned that 84% number early on. 15% of our population is transient across the country. They're moving from state to state to state to state. And so we're partnering up with 6 other right now affiliate states, and we want to do a better job working with law enforcement, correctional facilities, healthcare social workers, so they have access to the backdoor information on the app, so that we can truly have a coordinated of care effort to support and lift up people, not criminalize it, but lift up and support. So right now in the city of Des Moines, we'll be Dana and I are having a conversation about their neighborhood division. And this actually was an idea that came out of the DNA, Downtown Neighborhood Association, of saying, how do we do a better job of connecting your officers and the neighborhood division with our team of six street outreach social workers and have them better communicate with one another, even creating work orders for one another if need be. So if they have somebody, they can see if they're in our app in the system. And if they're not, they can create a work order for us to deploy our street outreach team to that location to better serve them. And then vice versa. If you have somebody that is being arrested for a crime similar to homelessness or food insecurity, maybe they were pickpocketing, they stole the candy bar because they were hungry, right? Please don't charge them with a crime. Give us a work order, and we will go work with that person, do a mental health assessment, help support them with their food security, with their housing, help regain self-sufficiency so that we never have to charge them with that crime. So there is a whole nother component to it that we actually learned from Honolulu. And they're working really closely with on the island of Oahu to address and to serve and street outreach through their app. And so we're looking to combine theirs with ours and vice versa, because we actually have a very large transient population between Hawaii, Colorado, Portland, well, Oregon, and Washington, and now Kansas and Missouri. So we're seeing escalating numbers. And it seems like a random group, but at this point we've talked to all of them as early adopters, and so we look to roll that out here in the second part of this year. But insights, we need
info. As the last question as we close out here, how can we help?
A second, we'll deploy it. We need people to download it. We need people to get it in the hands. If you see somebody panhandling, we're actually going to be giving out business cards. You can hand that person panhandling, here, download this app or go to the Housing Command Center at CISS. And by the way, if you don't want to do that, it's also a free ticket to the food truck.
Thank you.
That's the biggest thing. I can't tell you. My attorney wouldn't let me. I asked, Deb was in my office yesterday. I'm like, I'm going to give everybody a sneak peek. And then I was told, no. We call it Casper. What's that? It's on Apple and Android. Yep. Right now we call it Casper, and we are trying to figure out how to bury a ghost. So if anybody can help us with that.
No,
I appreciate it. Oh, I absolutely will. We will make sure everybody gets them. Thank you.
Yeah. Melissa just reminds us, we can't do it alone. It takes a village. It's frightening that here the population, homeless population, is largely hidden, particularly in rural areas. We're all humans. We need to care for the most vulnerable in our society. Societies should be measured how they treat all of their citizens. LGBTQ plus youth are often left homeless because they are rejected by their families. An intergenerational panel last night, there was someone my age, so many, many years ago, was kicked out of his home because his dad, he found out he was gay. His dad said, well, then he'd pack up and leave. So at 19, he was on his own. And so that continues today.